live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turfs Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
Welcome to the Water Zone. I'm Rob Starr, along with the magnificent water wizard of all, Mr. Chris Davey. Chris, how are you doing?
Awesome. Thank you very much, Rob Starr. Appreciate the accolades there. And we're just here we are once again, seventh weekend in a row coming up, and we're going to have a rainstorm. This one not connected to an atmospheric river, thankfully. We can ask Chris Austin about that a little bit later. But it's clouding up, and guess what? It's going to rain tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, we got, well, I don't know if we're going to get it here late in the afternoon. I'm doing a video concert with, well, it's not with, I mean, I have the video of the Eagles last tour, the one that you and I went and saw.
Yeah.
And so I'm as you know, I live near a big park here, and I have a big projector system, 17 by 14 foot screen and 2,000 watts of audio, and we're going to show that tomorrow to the neighborhood. So we do that once every month, and it's good to get all the neighbors coming out, bring their little cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, and sit back and watch a good concert. So I hope it doesn't rain. My wife was telling me it's going to be in the 50s, and there's going to be some wind, so we have to see what's going to happen, because I don't really want to schlep out all that electronic music equipment and have it rain on it. Got too much invested in that. But anyway, so...
If it's going to be cold like that, the best piece of advice is bring a friend.
Bring a friend and a blanket.
A close friend.
Yeah. Yes. I understand that well. So let's just bring Ms. Austin in. Chris, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great. I'm sitting in the rain that you're going to get tomorrow, Chris.
Oh.
So, you know, it's raining up here in the North State, and this is definitely not an atmospheric river. This is a very cold storm, and our temperatures yesterday it was like up to the 70s, I think, mid-70s, and then today, like, I don't even think we're going to get much out of the... We'll get just into the 50s, but just barely. So quite a difference.
Yep. So what's going on for the biggest stories we got going this week that you've reported on?
Well, let's see. We've had a lot of stuff going on, as always. We had the snow survey on Tuesday.
Out there.
Awesome. It's the April 1st. Snow survey, the one that we all talk about. I kept telling you, for the last 3 months, what doesn't matter then, what matters is April 1st, and so here we are. And the snowpack is very nice indeed, and I think that we will see some increase in water allocations coming for the state and federal water projects. I can't, I won't even hazard to guess how much, but I do think there'll be plenty up here in the North State. There'll be some more for the South, but pumping is from the South Delta pumps has been very challenging this year. A few weeks ago, there was a problem with steelhead getting entrained at the pumps or near the pumps. Again, somewhere in the vicinity of the pumps, the fish have died. They have not, maybe not in the pumps, but there. So it's been very difficult. And now there's another surge of this fish problem at the pumps. And when we can't export water out of the South of Delta, that really impacts the amounts available for those that depend on those deliveries south of Delta, is what we call them. And so that means farmland in the San Joaquin Valley and especially the Westlands Water District, which tends to be very vocal when they don't get, you know, what they feel is a fair allocation of water. It also means, you know, something less for the State Water Project in Southern California. This just means less percentage of their maximum amount that they would get. You know, every State Water Project contractor has a contract for X amount of water, and then, you know, the allocation that you hear from Department of Water Resources is, you know, like I think currently is 35%. So it's 35% of that contract maximum. It's very rarely 100%.
Wow.
I think it was when we had the really, really wet year, but generally not.
Well, can't you know, to protect the steelheads, isn't there some sort of fencing system or something that would prevent them from going into the pumping areas?
Yeah, well, the problem is that all the channels in the delta are headed towards the pump.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're a fish swimming down from the Central Valley, you're, you know, if in natural flow, that water is going to flow through the delta and out to sea. But when they're pumping in the South Delta, the water is not going out to sea. It's actually sucking water in and pulling all the water south. So the fish go with the water because they don't know, right? They're baby fish. They're swimming.
They're bum rushing the pumps is what you're telling me.
Yeah, so they kind of get sucked into the area, and you know, the problem is there's no way to prevent them from getting drawn there when the pumps are on. There just really isn't anything that can be done about that. So what they have to do is they have to pump less and create less of a draw. And there's actually a regulatory objective there that is how much negative flow that you can put on these two rivers in the delta, you know. So we already know we're going to make that river run backwards. Just how much backwards are we going to let it go? It's a very hard thing to be a juvenile fish in the delta.
I guess. No. That's kind of sad, though. I mean, you know, you got to do what you got to do, but...
Well, if we were going to build a new water system, if we were going to go into the delta and build it now, we would not have it configured any way like it is. I mean, they put those pumps in the late 60s. Excuse me. And that was really before we had the Endangered Species Act, and really it was that age where we were starting to understand how our changes had affected the ecosystem. I mean, when we were building Friant Dam in like the late 40s, early 50s, I think it was, they were building the dam, and these fish were coming up, salmon were coming up, and like trying to get over this dam that they were building, and they were just flinging themselves at the dam, and we didn't know what that meant at that time. It was like the people working on the dam were like, wow, that's pretty strange, right? We were still learning about what fish do and how they do it. And we didn't understand the impact of cutting off all these salmon from this upstream habitat. If we had to do it again, we certainly wouldn't put the pumps there, because when they turn them on, if they're pumping strong, they're sucking all the water south rather than letting it flow out to the bay and out to the ocean like it's meant to naturally go.
And I think in today's era, everybody is more in tune to understanding the balance of nature and the balance of human beings and what we need to survive and how the world's got to keep up with everything. So, yeah, I guess I can understand that. It's just a shame that that happens and, you know, kind of ruins everything. But you can't, well, We don't have the money to rebuild the whole system. So.
Well, we can't. And, you know, this is not meant to sound like an endorsement, but I will say that this is one of the things that this Delta Conveyance Project, the very controversial Delta Tunnel, is looking to mitigate, I guess, because at this point in time, if that Delta project, that Delta Tunnel was in place, they would be diverting water from North Delta through the tunnel, and we wouldn't be sucking water from the South, so the fish would be fine. And this would be exactly the time when they would be using that tunnel, especially now we have rain in the North Tunnel. In Northern California, there's a lot of water in the Sacramento River. This would be a time when they would be utilizing that tunnel, and the fish would be ineffective. And the difference between this North Delta intake that they want to build to the tunnels and the South Delta is that, you know, the South Delta is a dead end. I mean, all the roads lead to the South Delta, and there's nowhere else to go. On the intake that they're going to put on the Sacramento River, they're going to set flows that are so mild that the fish will simply, there'll be a screen there, but the fish will simply float by and go along their way. It's not going to, you know, turn around the river and the whole river's trying to go into the tunnel. It won't be anything like that, so they say. That would be hard to do anyways. But so that's sort of the reasoning behind the Delta Tunnel.
Are they going to open it up for tubing?
Yeah. Well, you should see the pictures, you know. This Delta Tunnel is nothing new. It was actually conceived, not the tunnel, but a passage of water around the Delta was conceived as the original part of the State Water Project. But when they went to build it, they ran out of money, so they didn't get that part built. So yeah. It's always sort of been envisioned to be part of the project. And so they actually did back in 1998, they were going to build this thing, and it would be called the Peripheral Canal. And it was, they actually did a statewide ballot measure on this, and it was turned down, amazingly turned down, like 98%. Amazing how much it was built. Voted down, the one of the amazing margin, but they had a lot of papers that, you know, and reports that the state produced at the time, and they did show people picnicking by the canal with the birds flying in the air, you know, like, hey, here's a family day, come and sit by the canal. So it's kind of funny to see that done in the, you know, 1960s art style.
Well, understand. Chris, jump on in when you can.
I got a question. Got a couple of questions, actually, because, Chris, I did follow the snow survey kind of, pretty much on point as it went through. As you know, Rob and I want to attend one of these years. And, you know, who doesn't like an April 1st? Snow survey that happens on Tuesday, April 2nd, but, you know, that's another story, right?
Well, it was a holiday, you know.
So. Yeah. So given that, and, I appreciate the story about the fish. I read that closely as well. But let me ask you, this is my question today, because other than fish and the snow survey, you know, I'm quite interested in all the restoration projects that are going over, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of them. But I thought an interesting story on Maven's notebook that caught my eye was from the Delta Stewardship Council that says, we're cutting green tape with the statutory exemption for restoration projects, or SERP, as they call
yes.
it. I just thought that was interesting the way they phrased it. Give us your insight.
Yeah, actually, you know, thank you for choosing something that I actually wrote about. Yeah.
I know.
They tried to do, they put together an initiative, I don't know, I think it was in the early years of the Newsom administration, called Cutting the Green Tape, because so many of these habitat restoration programs get really caught up in permitting quagmires. So they created a path line, excuse me, to streamline permitting for restoration projects that are purely restoration projects. And this has been put to use over the last, I think it's been 3 years since they had this particular exemption in place. And they facilitated like 20,000 acres of restoration. And it's a program that we're hoping that the legislature will renew because it's due to sunset next year. But it's really, you know, trying to address some of the barriers that we have, you know, because our CEQA, we have this, you know, California Environmental Quality Act, very strong regulations protecting the environment when you do projects, but it really does increase the cost, and there's been just, you know, you have to go through so many permitting agencies that they really are working to try and make it easier for the projects that are really good projects to get built. And they said that they're saving about $100,000 in 6 to 7 months of time in using the streamlined process. So, I mean, it's a good program, and I hope to see it continued.
Well, we read everything that you write, and we appreciate that. And like I said, I tell everybody, I don't know how you do it. I know there's only a certain amount of hours in the day, but unless you type with two hands and two different computers at the same time, I just don't know how you get it all done. But we certainly appreciate it. Well, we're going to come close here to our break and commercial break. And Chris, as always, you are a great part of this show, and we appreciate you coming on every week and giving an update to a lot of information that people don't really get or even don't know where to access. There's a lot of newspapers and things don't carry everything that you carry in your blog, and it's a shame because you can really get the whole picture when they read your stuff. So our listeners, please go to www.mavensnotebook.com. Become a subscriber. Get it on your PC, your laptop, your phone every single morning. Chris and I get that, and we thoroughly read it and enjoy it. And you can also become a sponsor if you'd like, and I'm sure Miss Austin would appreciate that for all the work that she does. And, I mean, this woman is just a mad typist, and she does a great job, and she knows all the people and all the stories, and she has a mind of her own, and it makes a great read. So appreciate that. So Chris, again, on behalf of our show, thank you very much.
All right. Good evening, everyone.
Have a great week, Chris.
Yep. And stay dry. All right. We're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back with our part two of a conversation. We had some very big FBI and government officials on the show talking about cybersecurity. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Out there, you're on your own. Do more. Do it faster. Do it better. The work is tough, and building an experienced team is even tougher. The moment you've got the game figured out, everything changes. It's hard to know where you stand. But in here, you'll find your footing. It's a place that's as much a community as it is a store. A place where knowing you and your business go deeper than simply knowing your name. A place where the solutions aren't limited to what's on the shelf, and the experts behind the counter pride themselves on going beyond the call. In here, you'll find people who see eye to eye, who stand shoulder to shoulder, who work side by side to build things, great things. In here, you'll find common ground. We are Site One, stronger together.
Welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone Show. Hope everybody's having a good time. We're going to continue our discussion we had with some very important people, and I'll remind you that who they were. It was Frank Taylor, and he was the former Undersecretary for Intelligence and Analysis at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And prior to that, he was Assistant Secretary of State for Diplomatic Security and Director of the Office of Foreign Missions. And he was one of the people that we had. We also had Sherry Ramsey will be joining. And Sherry was the former director of the National Security Agency, Central Security Service Threat Operations Center. And she has a great background in knowing about cyber. We had Ms. Hafsa Locke, and she was the FBI Department of Cybersecurity Chief. And a gentleman named Harry Hursty, who is a world-renowned data security expert. And he's the founder of Election Integrity Foundation and co-founder of The Voting Village. And he's a senior advisor at the Global Cambridge Advisors Group. So let's continue that discussion. And it's very interesting. We're going to ask lots of questions, and you're going to get a lot of information and answers to this. So it's a great, great segment. So here we go.
Can explain kind of what that is, and you know, how do people find it, kind of what kind of people live and visit and dwell on the dark web. Give us kind of like, you know, the overview of what the dark web is.
I heard it's, you don't go to www.darkweb.com. So from what I hear, it's used for strange things. But from an expert, tell us about that.
So dark web is not a one thing. There are number of different protocols, number of different pieces of software, number of different things which are all elements of dark web. In a common consensus, one of the most common is Tor, which is called onion routing. That particular flavor of dark web means that there are multiple intermediate proxy servers which are hiding your identity from the server you are reaching, and the server is, you don't know where the servers you are reaching to. So if your communication jumps from multiple different computers to another, being re-encrypted and protected for against detection until it gets to either a server, which is itself in part of that dark web network, or it gets to the exit node where it jumps back to the public internet. As everything, dark web has good uses and bad uses. Criminals love it because it's a wonderful way of hiding your actions. But for example, journalists in under suppressive governments need that kind of communication mechanism to do journalism. So it is neither absolutely bad or absolutely good. It's always a question of how you are going to use. If you look the other aspect, why dark web became a explosion of crime and why ransomware became explosion of crime, the answer is Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. The first ransomware softwares were asking you to mail, and literally mail, a check to a PO box in Panama. That is way too slow for if your files have been encrypted and there was no way of handling the money transaction. Now you have a cryptocurrencies which have a similar properties, anonymity, global transactions, and some of those are merged with the technologies of dark web, and especially merged with the technology, with the websites living in the dark web. So the actual way how crime works, it's not only the dark web, but it requires a rocket fuel, which fuels the ecosystem, the criminal ecosystems, and that's the cryptocurrencies.
I'm learning so much more about this. I had a daughter who was a Fed, and she's not in the cyber, wasn't in the cyber group, but very, very interesting, the more I hear about stuff like this. Frank, is it true that nation states like Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, they're seeking, I guess I'll use the term, cyber mercenaries to hack into government and commercial sites to cause serious hacks. Is that a truism?
Well, our adversaries use their own resources of their government, of their intelligence service, and criminal enterprises and cyber mercenaries, if you will, that have capability to try to penetrate our systems to gain control or access to information or data that they want. This has been ongoing. It has gotten more intense as cyberspace becomes more part of who we are as Americans and what our country, how our country operates. So absolutely, that is true, and it continues, and it makes Harry and Sherry's job even more difficult because the attacks come from so many different angles and from so many different places, and nation states are trying to cover up the source or their involvement with those folks, which makes attribution even more difficult going forward. But absolutely a part of the cyber landscape that we have to protect against.
So to get into the business that you guys do with cybersecurity protection and consulting, are there, Sherry, are there special degrees or certification requirements to become a cybersecurity professional, or just somebody who gets a software degree and is going to rock and roll, or they're going to, she's going to rock and roll into this job? Is, to me, it's specialized. Like, it's like being a doctor, and you get your general, and then you tell you what your specialty is going to be. Is that something that has to happen here?
You know, even though with a doctor, there's still a curriculum, you know, that doctors can follow. And pretty much it doesn't matter what school you go to. There's kind of an agreed upon curriculum, and that's, you know, you get that curriculum. We're not there yet in cybersecurity. It would be really nice if I could point out, or Hari could develop a curriculum and say, hey, if you go do this, then you're going to be a super duper, you know, cybersecurity person. Unfortunately, that's not true. There are a lot of different colleges and universities who teach classes in cybersecurity. Of course, probably the one at the top is, and the most well-known of those is Carnegie Mellon, but I think there's probably not a college anywhere that doesn't say they teach some sort of cybersecurity class, at least. There are a number of private institutions, one of which is the SANS Institute, probably one of the largest ones around on the globe, that teaches all kinds of cybersecurity classes. The problem is we have this big nebulous cybersecurity thing that continues to morph and change, and we don't have a great handle on it yet. And in fact, I will tell you that probably one of the best cybersecurity analysts that I've ever known did not have a college degree at all. He just was not interested. He learned on his own, was one of these kids at 12 or 13 who, that's what, you know, he built a computer, you know, he took his own computer apart and built another one. So I think first it's kind of, you kind of have to have an aptitude for that sort of thing. You have to, you know, want to be very curious. There's an investigative part of it, you know, there is definitely a foundation of technical information that you have to have. So I think it is a matter of, yes, getting that basic foundation of classes, either from a college or a university, learning on your own. There's all kinds of online classes. But then I think, you know, it's finding someone like Hari to go and work, you know, work with them and for them and be mentored by them and just kind of get that experience. And I think at the end of the day, we're all still just continuing to learn as we go. This is kind of a cat and mouse game. You know, we up our game in cybersecurity, and then the attackers go and up their game. We up our game again, and they go and up their game. And, you know, it's kind of always this cat and mouse, and unfortunately, we always have to talk about money, the cost of it. And so, you know, the cost of cybersecurity, how much does it cost? When I worked at the National Security Agency, a number of times I got to go to Congress and answer the question, how much does cybersecurity cost? What am I buying for my money? And often it's trying to tell them what is not going to happen because you spent money. And that's very difficult to categorize. So I think it is, we definitely need more and more people in the field. I think it's all of us need to be cybersecurity practitioners to some degree. If we own a cell phone, if we own a computer, then we need to know a little bit about cybersecurity. And I think that we are, as a nation, are probably pretty inadequate at having some way for all of us to be trained a bit in cybersecurity so that we can become what I'm going to call a good digital citizen, which is really just kind of understanding. Because, you know, I read the other day and I was shocked that I have more power in my cell phone than NASA had in their Apollo manned space mission. So that's a little scary when you think about it like that. And so, again, like I said, we all need to have some sort of cybersecurity education, and we're not there yet.
Yeah, I was just recently found out, like when you go to a restaurant, and actually it happened before during the pandemic, and you'd go in, they wouldn't give you a menu, they have a QR code on, mm-hmm. and this person was telling me, well, you know, they can put something in that QR code, and it can take over your telephone later down the road. Didn't know that. And years ago, I was involved in Frank, and you guys may know about it. It's called the Stu telephone, where people used to put their landline, the receiver down on the thing, and it was on hook, but you could still listen in. And so I worked on designing things for that. But there's so much of that a lot of people don't know. They think, oh, it's just simple. Nobody can do this. Nobody can hack me. Nobody, you know, why do I have to have a password for every credit card? I guess it's all important because bad things happen. Chris, I'll let you follow up with the follow-up question.
I think Harry's got a comment he'd like to make. Go ahead, Harry.
Yeah. So I'm one of those who don't have any degree. Also, there's different levels. What is your role in cybersecurity ecosystem? But when you look, I always, when people say, yeah, you have to be a white hat, I said, no, I'm non-fractioning black hat. At this moment, I don't fractioning black at crime, but I have to have the criminal mindset in order to be effective in what I do as a defender. So when you're looking the requirement and the mindset and the psychology of the fractioner, depending what level of the cyber security pyramid you work, that changes a lot. And on the top, you really have to be thinking, what if I would be a criminal, if I would want to steal your stuff, what I would do? And then you start looking that's called also threat hunting. You are looking for if somebody has already been here by having a hypothesis. If I would be a criminal, this is what I would do. Let's see if somebody has been here before me.
Well, I just wanted to follow up on Sherry's point. When we first started this in the Air Force, we went to Keesler Air Force Base where our communicators trained. We hired 6 one-stripe airmen that knew more about computers than everyone that was in their chain of command when we started the Defense Computer Forensic Organization. We now give the power of the cell phone that Sherry spoke about to 1 and 2 year olds. And so now we have infants that don't understand the power of what they have in their hands, and they're using this every day. So the notion of creating good digital citizens, the notion of training people the basics of cybersecurity are really the bedrock of how we begin to protect ourselves going forward. So I want to just reinforce Sherry's point that we have powerful machines that are more powerful than what took us to the moon, yet we don't understand the power of that and take the action to learn the vulnerabilities and what we can do to protect ourselves.
That's so true, and I learned that years ago with my grandkids when they were little. And they, you know, the parents always give them the phones to play with to keep them quiet. And so they came over one day and they used my phone to play some game. And the next time I went to use my thing, I had such weird stuff on that machine, on that phone, that I couldn't get rid of it. Chris, I'll let you follow up.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Hey, listen, so, I mean, this subject is absolutely enthralling to me. Rob knows that for sure. But there's been kind of a question percolating in my head all through this interview. We've been talking about us as individuals and our responsibility to protect ourselves, cell phone usage and personal computers and all that. But maybe I can ask a question if we scale it up to, like the agency level in our infrastructure, critical infrastructure in the U.S. I mean, we had just recently the Colonial Pipeline issue and all that stuff that happened there. So other agencies, especially utility agencies and private companies and stuff like that, is there some sort of regulatory requirement that these companies and agencies have to protect themselves? And, you know, can any of you describe what that is, if it exists?
I'll start, and probably Sherry and Ari can chime in. CISA was created to begin that process, or at least to coordinate the U.S. government's effort to work with our private sector. And again, 85% of the critical infrastructure resides in private hands, to better share information, share best practices, and get people to understand the nature of the threat and how that threat manifests itself in their systems. The White House, the Biden administration, created the cybersecurity director at the NSC to better coordinate across government our efforts to help our citizens and our industries to conduct cybersecurity operations. But there is no one place where all that kind of comes together. Sherry, you may have a thought on that. The NSA does lots of things supporting our military operations, but it's CISA, it's DHS, it's the White House National Security Cyber Organization that has begun the process of trying to organize this in a way that allows the U.S. government to support the threats and risks as we learn about them. The FBI plays a role, the intel community plays a role, but from a policy and execution point of view, it's primarily and CISA. Sherry?
So yeah, I think DHS and CISA has done a really nice job supporting the effort to identify what we're calling critical infrastructure. And that is, you know, infrastructure in our country that is imperative to our economic and national security. And I think one of the last ones that have been added is election security, after all the hullabaloo with, you know, our elections and, you know, were votes counted wrong and, you know, had they been tampered with and all that. So I think CISA has done a really good job of creating these communities of interest, if you will. There's a transportation sector, there's a financial sector, you know, there is a water sector, there's an energy sector, there's retail. So there's a number of these, and I've lost track. I think there's 30 something of them now, maybe 32 or something like that. And so within these groups, they are trying to facilitate the sharing of information, the sharing of threat information, the sharing of mitigation information. I know that CISA and the FBI and the National Security Agency, as well as I think DC3 within the Department of Defense, work fairly closely together these days, and they put out bulletins, if you will, you know, all kinds of information in those bulletins. Now, having said all of that, we're still not where we need to be. I think the only, I could be wrong, Frank, you may know more, I think the only one of these is actually what I would call regulated is the banking industry. And, you know, they've been regulated for years. They were regulated before there's a cyber threat. And so it, you know, it just kind of made sense that these regulations extend into that. Do the regulations make them more secure? We can debate that another day. But, you know, we live in a free society. People don't want to be regulated. And most pieces of the critical infrastructure are owned by private citizens. So this makes an already very, very difficult problem even more complex and even more challenging. And so it is simply a matter of, you know, trying to get coalitions of the willing, trying to get the word out there. I don't know that more regulation will ever fly. I don't know that that'll ever be the right answer. But I think people are starting to realize, mainly just because of the sheer numbers of attacks that have happened and the amount of, in dollars, in real dollars, of loss, whether it be to computers, to information, to lost business, to lost operations, and as Hari even alluded to earlier, to loss of life. You know, it is, we have to figure this out. And it's still out there in front of us. So we need lots of people to start learning more about this complex thing called cybersecurity. We need them to start learning more about the threat, more about this problem, and all of us coming together at whatever role we have, whether it be trying to be a good digital citizen or whether it's a hardcore, you know, cybersecurity forensic analyst trying to figure out what's happened and so forth. That's what we need to do.
Jerry, I have a quick follow-up question then. It kind of just, you know, again, blends in my head here. So if and when one of these entities in one of these sectors does get attacked or does receive a threat, are they obligated to tell the government of that? Is there some sort of affirmative reporting that's required?
For financial institutions, absolutely. Frank, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe for the others, I do not believe that there's any.
It's found, but because of the relationships that CISA and others had built with the private sector, there's a lot more information sharing being done voluntarily. This isn't something you can, you know, force down someone's throat. But over time, the private sector has gained confidence in the government and how the government uses that data and shares that data confidentially, such that they don't feel vulnerable in providing that information going forward. It was very tough when we started 20 years ago. It's a lot easier today, but there's still room for improvement. I think Harry had an additional comment.
Every other domain, we fight a war: land, sea, undersea, air, and space are governed by laws of physics and laws of nature. The two domains we fight a wars with no borders are cyber and information space. I'm joining this call right now from Singapore, from the other side of the world. And when we look cyberspace, there are a lot of international laws, but also this is a game of weakest link. Everybody is at the same time a potential attacker because their country might be the origin of attack and also victim. And it's very important that every country has a computer emergency task force, and there's a confidence that nations, regardless of how their national domestic legislation works, are honoring international law and are participating in information sharing, so that when attack happens and we don't know what it is, we can call to the other side of the border, see who you think is doing this, what are the indicators of compromise, what do you see? And all of this international cooperation across the globe is really the key for more secure world, more secure cyberspace.
Yeah. Well, question for everybody, and to wrap this up is, so what is your interpretation, or how do you believe what the future of cyber attacks is going to be? I'm guessing it's going to be really bad, and it's going to get a lot more serious from some enemies and such. But what do you see or hear?
I just tell us. It, and Sherry and Hari will have other thoughts. Look, every day we just landed the first spaceship on the moon by the U.S. and compute power that took to do that is significant. There's discussions of weapons in space. There's discussions of all sorts of other vulnerabilities coming down the road. So I think this is going to continue to be a clear strategic threat. And as systems become more sophisticated, AI and deep fakes and all the other sort of stuff that you're hearing people talk about make it even more complicated. And that's why we need to continue to evolve our cyber warriors to understand that environment and to be able to at least stay abreast of it, if not ahead of it.
Sherry, what do you say?
I think this thing that we're calling artificial intelligence has really, you know, kind of sprung onto the landscape. It's really driven, I think, an increase in the number of attacks that we've seen, particularly in 2023, and I don't expect that to change this year. But it's also contributed to improvements in the defense. So, you know, again, it's one of those things, it's caused more attacks, but it's given us more opportunities, you know, for defense. And I think we really need to be prepared to take advantage of that. We've seen ransomware grow into a dominant cyber threat over the last several years. It's really become prolific and potent and extremely effective. It's now being even exploited into larger, incorporated into larger campaigns. I think that trend is going to continue and we're going to see more ransomware. I think the shift to more remote working, you know, most of us are now working from home when we can. And so I think that's really causing the need to kind of shift our whole thought of cybersecurity and cybersecurity architecture to where we're talking about very distributed infrastructures and people working kind of in isolation from their house. That's a huge challenge, I think, in terms of creating these cybersecurity architectures. So I think, you know, as and I believe we've seen other countries incorporate cyber attacks into their war doctrine. And so I think we will routinely see cyber as a part of, you know, a part of that in the future. So again, you know, more, I think more challenges, maybe more opportunities for us to do well. And again, I think our focus needs to be on education, you know, education of the general citizen, education of our kids, encouraging more people to go into the field, and then picking out, you know, that rare person who can think like a criminal, but who isn't one, and who, you know, will help the white hat guys do good in this thing we're calling cybersecurity.
Interesting. Wow. I'm blown away by talking to experts in a field that I know nothing about, and I'm learning a lot. Harry, you have a comment?
I think the one elephant in the room is that today, a lot of the defenders are confusing information space, so influence operations, all of that as a cyber. Those are two different spaces. Cyber is technical, information is between our ears and in our brain. AI is going to try this misinformation, disinformation, all of that. That's the information space and influence operations, a cognitive attack against human brain. And we need to develop human training programs to have a human firewall. That's one problem. The other part is then the technical. But we are going to a war of AI versus AI. Our adversaries always study every defense software, every defense device we have. And AI is no different. The difference is always going to be human. And there is a temptation in the vendor space to say, oh, you can buy this stuff and they will alleviate your workforce need. That's not going to happen. So this is going to be eventually AI versus AI, whether it's about our minds and warfare, I don't mean by information warfare or cyber operations. And humans are the ones who are going to make the difference who is going to win this war and how this is going to turn out. So we have to be always remembering this is a human, the threats are human, and the victims are human. Computer attack tools. And AI is such a better mousetrap.
I agree. Chris, any follow-ups?
No, I don't. It's been just so interesting, informative, revealing, impactful, thought-provoking. It's been just a terrific. Yeah, one more thing. So maybe for our listeners, we can provide some guidance, or you guys can provide some guidance on where anybody listening to this, especially in the water segment in our industry, where can they go to get more information? Sherry, maybe start with you.
Oh, absolutely. I think a perfect place to begin to get more information is with CISA, within the Department of Homeland Security. CISA has the lead for the government in terms of information sharing, and they work very closely with the Department of Defense, with the National Security Agency, and with the FBI to put out information bulletins, all kinds of threat information. So I think if you go to CISA's webpage, There will definitely be a lot of information there, but also I think there'll be information on the FBI's homepage, on NSA's homepage, and so forth. And I think there you will find an organization of a lot of people of like minds. And hopefully when we work all this together, we can win at the end of the day.
I agree. It's where a good place to start, and certainly will not be the last place that you visit. But starting at CIS is a good idea for folks in the infrastructure business.
Information sharing and analysis centers. So there's a website, waterisec.org, and that is the information sharing and analysis center for water sector.
Okay, great. Well, we want to thank Frank and Sherry and Harry for joining us today, and actually for 2 days, and we'll appreciate that. So thanks a lot for coming on. We do appreciate it.
All right, Chris, that was an interesting conversation, and I wish we could have more time. I appreciate Harry calling in from Europe, and he was 8 hours ahead of us and in the middle of the night for him and everybody else on the East Coast who participated in this. You know what makes me think, what's the motivation for somebody to be a hacker? I have no idea. Is it to see if they can break the rules, or what do you think, Chris?
I think that's part of it, Rob, probably, but the widespread and ever present influence of money has a lot to do with it as well. I'm sure.
Yeah, it's interesting, because our water industry really has to worry about what's going on. That's, in fact, that was a topic that the San Bernardino County Water Symposium is going to take up in August. They're going to have somebody.
Yeah.
In fact, they wanted somebody from our show, people that we had on the show, to come on to their event and talk about that. But, as I said at the first part, there was a water agency that was hacked in Pennsylvania. And, the electrical grids get attacked. And we're going to have some people on from ConocoPhillips down the road to talk about what they're doing in water. Even though they're an oil company, they've got a joint venture with Mexico, and they're going to work on some things to reproduce or reuse water. But you just worry about somebody going in and manipulating the computers and changing the recipes of how they clean the water and what could happen. I mean, it's pretty serious because, once all that happens, we're dead in the water, or without the water.
No pun intended. I think that cyber attacks is just part of it, but physical attacks on water infrastructure as well as energy infrastructure are a big deal, and something that our listeners can think about is we'll be covering some of that stuff a little bit later. And Rob, I got to tell you, man, just for our listeners, right, getting and coordinating this two-part interview that we had with those guys was so much fun. And just talking to them as we're preparing, getting the questions ready, and let our listeners know when you get this caliber of folks on there and FBI and security issues, it was not an easy task, Rob, as you and I both know, but a great achievement.
Yep. We're going to probably have some governors coming up from New Mexico. The lady is the governor there with the ConocoPhillips people, it's exciting to learn. And you know what scares me a little bit, with AI and computers. When you see a 15-year-old kid can break in or hack a U.S. government Department of Defense computer system, that scares me. And with all this artificial intelligence, that said they can duplicate your voice, they can duplicate everything. I mean, look at the drones. They fly drones from the U.S. overseas, and the guy's sitting there and playing with a joystick like he's playing a game. I mean, that's that much advanced that we don't realize what they can do. And I used to laugh when I was younger and saw the first James Bond movie with the jet pack that he had on his back. Everybody laughed at that stuff. But, if you can think about something, it can be developed. And we're seeing that. I mean, my lifetime used to take 10, 20 years for a new product or new technology. Now it's like every 6 months. It's just amazing to me. Well, we're about at the end of our show. I do appreciate Chris sharing the time with you and going through these interviews with some really interesting people. And we're going to keep that up. And thanks to our audience who made us number one on FeedSpot globally. So we appreciate that. So everything is coming up rain this weekend, I hear. So everybody try to keep dry. And the thing that's most important that Chris and I tell everybody at the end of our show is, please help
keep
the planet
blue.
And, well,